Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. Hello, this is Jane Turner with Whistleblower Network News, Whistleblower of the Week. And today, I'm extremely happy to have on John Clark. John is a social worker of 40 years in Africa, and he is deeply involved with whistleblowers from Africa. And so he is really a special human being, and I'm so glad to have him on our show because he has with him today Patrick Maduna. And Patrick has this incredible story to tell. But before we start, John, I want to say hello and how proud I am to be able to interact with you today. You're one of my heroes.
Well, Dan, you flatter me and turn my face more blushed and red than it is already. And I do hasten to say that I'm just really doing what social workers are meant to do. And it's good to be back on your show. You were really helpful to me. What was it, 2-3 years ago when you interviewed me before and you helped me get my bearings?
Yes, and I'll tell you what, you are doing incredible work in Africa. You believe in psychosocial and spiritual support for whistleblowers, which I think is an incredible, incredible suggestion and should be implemented by governments. Which brings me to this concept that we're kind of having a worldwide awakening to the policies that need to be implemented concerning whistleblowers, from you in South Africa to Georgina Halford Hall in the UK whistleblower section. Worldwide, people are becoming aware of the fact that whistleblowers need to be protected, and the truths that they speak to power are incredibly important. So before we start with Patrick, we need to get a couple of definitions to bring people up to speed concerning South Africa and whistleblowing there. Would you please explain to us, if you would, John, about SLAPs, which are very big in the UK also, and in SLOW. These are all acronyms, but they're very important. And BEE. Would you explain those three things for our listeners, which will make the story more knowledgeable?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Jane. Yeah. A slap suit is actually a term which I think came from the North America, Canada, United States, strategic litigation against public participation. Now, my ears pricked up when I first got that acronym, because a social worker's first responsibility is to challenge social injustices to ensure that people most affected by adverse conditions can participate in decision-making processes that affect them. So the very idea of a slap suit to limit that is ipso facto a undermining of a professional mandate of a social worker. And so in that sense, I kind of thought, well, I have privilege. I'm a white South African who's benefited from the past. And how can I use that privilege in such a way as to hopefully ensure that younger social workers now in a situation of democracy can still be attuned to the fact that even though apartheid's long gone as a institutionalized racist system, power still remains, and power still finds itself in some sort of relationship with truth that's a bit allergic. And that's really a historical reality. If you think way back from the French Revolution onwards, power and truth always seem to be on a bit of a collision course. Now, how do you mediate between power and truth? Well, it's through freedom, and it therefore means that we've got to push back the boundaries and any attempt to close down the space for an open, transparent, engaging discourse around truth. And that's really, in a sense, why a slap suit is to stop that. And I just sort of came up with the idea one day working whistleblowers, just it makes a nice acronym. It's basically something with the same sort of genetic makeup as a slap suit. It's still the abuse of the legal process as a way of actually intimidating and shutting down any dissent and criticism. And I just sort of applied to whistleblowers. It's a slow suit, strategic litigation on whistleblowers. And I've now come up with a third one, which is to complete the triad, which is also the same basic variation on the theme, a slam suit, strategic litigation against media. But the common denominator, it's about truth versus power and the necessity for freedom of expression, responsible freedom of expression, and the elimination of any obstacles and practices which actually shut down that space. Because, maybe just make this point, as I've experienced with whistleblowers, power has no defense against truth. That's why it tries to suppress it. And we've seen that that's so vividly expressed in what happened under apartheid. And of course, it should not be as we thought that in the democracy came in 1994, that, you know, we'd, you know, throw that out, that was history. But, you know, power is it's in the very nature of power that it would seek to actually preserve its own privilege and not like to be, in a sense, held accountable. And that's what democracy is, having all these checks and balances.
Yes.
The slap and slow and slam.
That's why I admire you so much, John. You are really on top of this. And tell me, in Africa, is there a certain danger in being a whistleblower? You know, I think of Aristonicus, who was the Cato Manor whistleblower, and Masula Mothapu, who was the Trillian whistleblower. Mm. And, you know, people actually get killed for being a whistleblower in Africa. And Patrick, in fact, it happened to him, an attempt on his life. So is it different being a whistleblower in Africa than any other part of the world?
Well, I guess the issue is wherever there is an erosion of the rule of law, that you will then have that tendency. What we are trying to in South Africa is to buttress the rule of law as a conflict resolution mechanism, you know, and my big concern is that, and we can go into the historical reasons about long, many years of colonialism and all the rest, where there is still a very strong concern that Africa's resources have been exploited and used for the benefit of the development of the West and the North, and that they've left us with institutions, to some extent, which have, rather than being empowering, have actually constrained democracy and participation, because it's always so sophisticated and controlled by people with this, you know, this superior legal knowledge and all the rest.
Yeah.
At the expense of indigenous knowledge systems and indigenous understandings of justice and that, which have basically been seen to be second class and sort of marginalized and sidelined. Now, anyway, that's a long, complex issue that we could go into. But I do have to say, at a lived reality, I got involved in this work when 2016, one of my clients who was, he never called himself a whistleblower, but he was in effect that. He was the leader of a community which was opposing an Australian mining company's ambitions to mine their ancestral lands for titanium. And we won in the courts the first time around. We didn't even have to go to court. We managed to get that stuff, that mining rights revoked. And that's when they then became dangerous, because they'd run out of ideas and they then started targeting and they killed him. And that was really what shocked me into a whole new thrust in my work as a social worker, Because we're not meant to be the story. We're not meant to be out there. We're meant to support people to find their own voice, empower them, attach, connect them with the media, with lawyers, so that they can basically participate and not be in any way felt being patronized. However, when they started killing my clients, I thought, for goodness sake, I've got to stick my head above the parapet, given my relative privilege, and actually start naming, unmasking, and engaging the powers myself. And then I attracted myself a slap suit as a consequence of that, which, as far as I was concerned, you know, I'm still alive. My client was killed. Mm. So, and, you know, and basically that was 7.5 years ago. And that then what led me into particularly working with whistleblowers, because I realized that I signed up for this. Patrick and people like himself didn't sign up for it. They were just simply doing their jobs. And they didn't have the requisite support systems and knowledge and experience. So it's been a very satisfying experience in my latter part of my career to be able to just say, well, look, here's something we can do. And what we do have going for us in South Africa is an excellent constitution and a Bill of Rights, which entrenches freedom of expression and dignity and various other rights and access to information. And we've now won significant constitutional court judgments that have outlawed slap suits, slow suits, and slam suits. And that very judgment that came out of my whole experience in supporting my clients in the Wild Coast and stopping this mining has been used very effectively, not least of all by a lawyer representing a journalist who has been slapped by our former president, Jacob Zuma. Karen Maughan is a journalist. She's a wonderful journalist who's done extraordinary work. And they went after her. And that same legislation has been significantly used in that sense and is being used in other respects. And we're compiling a whole sort of dossier of case law, which has now been used to great effect. And so we are in South Africa in a good space in this thing. And that's why people like Patrick can start feeling a little more confident to coming out and being able to speak their truth to the powers that be, and have a little less anxiety about the fact that they're going to suffer retaliation. However, one major point to say, I've also learned that when you win in court in terms of constraining those, in terms of a legal method of trying to stop you, it's not to say that they're not going to resort to extra legal measures. And that's why I've been concerned to make sure that Patrick's safe. He's moved around a bit. He won't even tell people where he is right now. But he, you know, and also we need to kind of source him a bulletproof vest for himself. And I'm looking for one myself because, you know, you know, I know that the you know, the thugocratic regime that kind of tends to run things in this country doesn't want to see whistleblowers succeed.
No.
Because it's bad for business. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, and maybe we can explore further.
Well, I hope if anybody's listening, they may have some contact with people who make, you know, those kind of vests. I know I wore one in my career as an FBI agent, and there's got to be people who are concerned enough about whistleblowers who may step forward to provide that to you.
Hi, we'll be right back with more of Whistleblower of the Week after a quick message from one of our whistleblower friends. Don't go anywhere. Hello, this is Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and host of the Whistleblower of the Week podcast. Whistleblower Network News takes great pride in offering high-quality, independent journalism on all things whistleblowing. From profiling whistleblowers to covering breaking whistleblower stories to exclusive investigative reporting on government whistleblower programs, WNN provides readers with timely, up-to-date information that you cannot get elsewhere. With your support, Whistleblower Network News can continue to play a vital role in covering whistleblower stories that other outlets often overlook, and bring you whistleblower stories that deserve to be told. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/support to donate today. Again, whistleblowersblog.org/support. Thank you.
Patrick, I am so happy to have you on Whistleblower of the Week because you are a hero. But initially, you did not know you were a hero or a whistleblower, did you? Tell us initially, and tell us about BEE, and how this works into the story.
So BEE actually represent Black economic empowerment, the inclusion of Black people into the economy, for them to participate in the economy. So in this regard, we were part of Avis. We worked for Avis, which is a global company, but now owned by Barloworld South Africa. We were providing a service to Shell. So it then happened that Shell and Barloworld came together and decided to create a triple BEE initiative. So what was going to happen, they were going to increase their BEE scorecard. Shell would increase their BEE scorecard, as well as Barloworld would increase their BEE scorecard, meaning they would probably have an upper hand or an advantage in getting, you know, work or contracts or tenders with the government, and it would actually alleviate their status. So for them, setting up what it was, what is actually called as Lokiwe, which is the company they created, it was good for them as well as beneficial to us, all the employees. So what they did is they created this company, which is owned by a trust. The trust was created so that it will manage and serve the interest of the beneficiaries, who are the employees. It so happened that I was also elected to be a trustee, as well as be part of the executive management at PTY. So the BEE initiative, it was actually created or designed to empower the Black majority in South Africa who were isolated to participating in the economy during the apartheid era.
Gotcha. And Shell, of course, Shell Oil is a worldwide company. So they partner up with a local group, which you were a part of, and that allegedly should help everybody.
Absolutely. Yes.
Excellent.
They partnered up with Barloworld. Barloworld is also an international company.
Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Create this small company, which will provide a luxury shuttle service.
Luxury shopping service. And you were a trustee, and you were responsible for certain things there that were critical.
Absolutely. Yes.
So tell us how you became a whistleblower, who initially that title, you didn't embrace that or really understand it, did you?
Absolutely didn't. I didn't. Actually, John, you know, made me understand. He took his time. He would come to me. He would explain to me to say, this is where you fall. Now, I didn't really understand. He brought books, brought other whistleblowers to my house, and they spoke to me, and I realized what this is and the magnitude of this. And he also brought me a lot of books written by whistleblowers, like Cynthia, many of them. And I read through, and I was able to actually do a deep dive analysis and understand what this is and the implications. I even understood what the previous whistleblowers went through. So I only understood from there that it's only going to get tougher as we go along. So I think John, in that regard, prepared me very, very well. He took his time, I won't lie to you, to nurture me with all this information. He didn't just bombard me with the information, but he made sure he wanted to know what are you thinking, what are you going through, what is this, until I really understood that my position, actually I'm now a whistleblower. So just to give a brief description of how I got there, as you asked, as a trustee, I had a fiduciary duty to ensure that PTY is run properly and it serves the interest of all the beneficiaries, which is the employees including myself. So in the on the board of trustees, we had myself, another gentleman in Cape Town, and the general manager, who became a trustee by default, by being the general manager. Then we had a representative from Shell. Barloworld did not elect a representative from Shell to become a trustee. Mm-hmm. So after 3 years, we had to declare dividends. So we started trading 2017, 2018, 2019. 2019, that is where I started asking questions about money. When I remember correctly, we had to have an annual budget discussion amongst the executive management. I could not participate in that because I requested for audited financials for the 2 years, which is 2017 and 2018, so that we can understand where we didn't do right and where we need to actually polish ourselves for 2019. Those audited finances were not there. They couldn't provide me with those audited finances. That is when the issues started. And it was the third year we needed to declare dividends. And towards the end of 2019, the resistance was growing because I needed those audited finances, because now I actually need to give these employees answers. They can take me to court in my personal capacity as a trustee because I have a duty of care. And yes. After that, I stopped getting a salary increase in the company in 2019. 2020, I never got one. 2021, going forward, I never got another one. So that was the retaliation. I started realizing there's a problem. I made this disclosure to my legal team, and they wrote to the business to demand audited financials from the business. The business had none. So they decided they're going to refuse to provide those financials. That was another issue. We then escalated the matter. We wrote to the BEE Commission. We have a commission that regulates the black economic empowerment. We wrote to the BEE Commission because now it was clear that if they are refusing with financials, and no employee has ever had access to finance to financials, it's clear that they are actually sugarcoating something. The only answer I got from management, from Gerard Martin, who was the general manager, was that he doesn't owe me any reports or any finances, because those finances or financial reports, audited finances, are actually provided and given to Mr. Justice Hlonipho Mtolo, who worked for Shell. Let me just give you a brief description about Hlonipho. Mr. Hlonipho Justice Mtolo was the chairperson of Shell. As he was the chairperson of Shell, he was also the chairperson of the Locure board, our company board. That was a conflict already. Because yes. he is at Locure, assisting Locure to navigate through Shell, and is also at Shell, assisting Shell to hold this contractors accountable, either ways, or running the entire business. So that was a conflict on its own. I just wanted to highlight that. So when he said he actually gives this to Justice, he doesn't owe them to me, we then wrote to the BEE Commission. The BEE Commission, we said, okay, this is what is happening. It's clear we've been created as a vehicle to defraud Shell. Please, I asked the BEE Commission to investigate this matter. Through my legal team, they wrote to them, and they also wrote to Shell as well as Lokiwe. So the BEE wrote to our company as well as Shell, and it seems as if Shell did not participate in a manner that was expected, as well as our company did not participate in a manner that was expected. As we speak to date, a little bit of a fast forward, Shell lost their level 1 BEE scorecard. They went to level 2. I think it's as a result of that investigation, because they refused to participate. So after making that disclosure to the BEE Commission, I also then went to Shell. We had Shell downstream and Shell upstream. Shell downstream is Shell South Africa. Upstream is the international platform. I went to the Shell downstream and I pleaded my case. I spoke to the head of Legal of South Africa, Ms. Thabile, and I also spoke to the CFO, Ms. Barbara Makubedu, because now I was making a protected disclosure to them. I needed the head of legal as well as the CFO in her capacity as a director at Shell. I made the disclosure. I told them what is happening with regards to inflated invoices and the service that we were providing and what was done with the service. I gave them all the details. So what they did from there, I asked them to say if they conduct a forensic audit, they will get to the gist of this and they will get the right people and the names of the people. And I even mentioned to say when if they were to do a due diligence properly, they will uproot senior people at Shell.
Gotcha. Patrick, were doing your due diligence as sitting on the board there as a trustee, and you had a fiduciary, I would think, responsibility as a trustee. And that's what you were pursuing. And simply what you found was the company there was ripping off Shell.
Absolutely, yes.
So they were taking monies from Shell, and you took that to Shell and showed them. Why do you suppose Shell wasn't that concerned over being ripped off?
Because the senior employees at Shell were highly implicated. Remember, Shell was our company was created by Shell, but who initiated the idea? It was senior employees at Shell, the decision makers at Shell. So when I disclosed this, I even asked this the CFO to say, just do a dummy assessment into what I'm giving to you, because I gave them evidence and I told them where to get evidence. I told them you must request this from your own department, and then if they need more information, they can always get it from the company. What actually happened, I remember I reported this around 2021 in May, and end of July, the CFO resigned. And that was the first one. Secondly, the contract owner was investigated of what I had alleged. They investigated her, and she was charged and she resigned as well. And then I made a protected disclosure to the global platform as well, which they investigated the matter I think amongst other issues, as well as having John putting out these issues on the platform. We had the chairman of Shell resign, I think, a few weeks back. I also made a protected disclosure to this SAPS, South African Police Service. That was in 2021, I think it was end of October, early November. And after opening the case with the crimes intelligence, they had to inform Shell to say there's a case opened here by Patrick. And just 2 weeks after I had opened the case, after Shell was informed, then I took the bullet. So it was not a coincidence.
Well, Patrick, if it's a protected disclosure, why did they identify you?
It's a million
dollar
question
you can't answer.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. You expected, though, to remain anonymous, correct?
Absolutely. I expected to remain anonymous, but I was not willing to hide from the truth. I was willing to participate in the investigation so that they could reach to me, I could reach to them. So I didn't want this to become sort of an anonymous, you know, tip off, and then whether they investigate it or not, then it will always lie with them. But I wanted to participate this to ensure that the truth comes to light.
So you were willing to stand up, Patrick, and say, yes, I was the one who made that disclosure, and I'm willing to admit to it. So you didn't have any fear at that time because you felt you were doing the right thing.
course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't have any fear because, amongst other things, the trust didn't even have an account, a bank account. And then, which means if PTY declares that they declared maybe 3 million into the trust, which didn't have an account, that would have meant I would have laundered that money and. So to me, it was mostly to clear my name and say I had nothing to do with this and I did not participate in any wrongdoings. But it seems the business was pushing back and that was very suspicious.
Do you think that there were certain people that were receiving kickbacks?
I firmly believe that. I firmly believe that. There is one thing that John taught me all along, and since knowing him, he says, if you're speaking the truth to, he said to me, if speaking the truth to power doesn't bring retaliation, either it wasn't real truth or it wasn't real power. That's I was taught by him to understand that power and truth will always tend to collide. That's when I realized.
Okay. So yes. There might be a cover-up that was occurring because, of course, a multinational company doesn't want something like that to get out, correct?
Absolutely.
That there might be kickbacks going on or their own personnel were involved?
Absolutely.
So shortly after you notified the police, tell us about somebody taking a shot at you, which we have photographic evidence of.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
So I have I was actually driving at night because I actually had to be vigilant and try and drive either very early in the morning or late at night so that I can see who is following me and who is not, because I had actually noticed cars that seemed to follow me while I was cycling, which I eventually stopped doing because he would see the same car at the start, in the middle of my cycling, maybe towards where I need to make a turn. And at sometimes I would even not feel comfortable and just take an Uber back home with the bike. And then eventually, you know, my anxieties grew and then eventually I stopped cycling outdoors. I was doing it indoors. And I started taking notice and I would see cars when I'm driving off my estate, and then I would see those cars while I'm also driving on the road. At first it was like, are they trying to intimidate me or are they actually trying to monitor my patterns to say this is how I drive from work, from home to work and then back, and my habits on the road? And then that led me to be a little bit cautious and careful, which is why I decided to drive late at night or either very early in the morning so that I can see who is following me. And in this regard, there were gunshots and I drove as fast as I possibly can and I got home. I didn't see the car that it actually had a bullet at the time when I got home. I was like, hey, that was too close. And I woke up in the morning, I drove to work, and only when I opened the boot, I realized there's a bullet hole. And then I drove straight to the police station to report the matter.
Wow. You know, and people really have to understand that paranoia isn't paranoia if it's true, because in South Africa, whistleblowers do get killed. I mean, it is not something that is just a figment of anyone's imagination. It does happen, doesn't it?
Yes, it does happen. You know, as you're saying that, I think four weeks ago in Randburg, the two witnesses were shot outside the court. You can Google the story. It's up there, and it's all the good whistleblowers or good people who decided to try and uncover all this corruption. Most of them have been killed. Big names have been killed. So John is aware of that. In South Africa, it's a thing. The best way to eliminate evidence is to kill the witness.
So what is your government doing about that? Obviously, it's a well-known phenomenon. So what is your government doing about protecting their whistleblowers?
I think, please, John, come in with that one, because you have dealt with a couple of whistleblowers. Probably you would have a better...
So, yeah, tell us, John, what is your government doing? The least they can do is protect their whistleblowers.
And the, you know, the witnesses in criminal cases, and that, as Patrick said, that is, we have a witness protection program. But there is, I mean, I grappled with that question for a long time. And unfortunately, one of my good friends, who's an expert on best practice and anti-corruption strategy, and she did her whole dissertation at International University in Prague, where they looked at best practices. And she came and she said, you know, South Africa is at least a decade behind the rest of the world in terms of its legislative and policy initiatives. And she particularly felt that whistleblowing has been shown in terms of best practice, is the best deterrent to particularly financial crimes.
Yes.
He said, it is just so obvious that at a far lesser cost of what it would take to, you know, recruit hundreds more police officers and things like that, just by having a proper legislation which actually properly incentivizes whistleblowing, number one. And the best... The place she regards as being the only place in the world where there seems to be some success in this is the United States, with your False Claims Act, which incentivizes whistleblowing. Because financial crimes are very difficult to prosecute, but any corrupt practices takes two to tango. So if you can introduce an element of distrust between the two potential, kind of collaborators, and it immediately deters the process. So that's something which we've been unfortunately arguing about for far too long, whilst the situation gets worse, because people feel that whistleblowing shouldn't be incentivized in that way. We don't want bounty hunters and all the rest. So that's another debate. But the point is, whatever your kind of principled position on it, is that she also found that the criminal syndicates have got control of so many instruments in the wake of our state capture that they will do everything they can to retard and delay any meaningful progress on this matter, because it's bad for business. And it's almost like so self-evident. And as our government is so deeply implicated after the State Capture Commission, which has found such appalling abuses of power, where we've just had, in fact, today, a good friend of mine has announced he's resigning from the ANC in disgust. This man has been a veteran of the ANC for 60 years, and he's got to the point where he just has said they only pay lip service to this. They don't vet candidates for election. They don't do any, because this criminal, she calls the term a thugocratic machine that actually controls all the levers. And I think that's, for me, the explanation. So I've been sort of going on about that for a long time. I had a big run-in with the Deputy Minister of Justice a couple of months ago, precisely on this matter, because the Protected Disclosures Act is considered by many countries as being quite a good piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. We believe it's actually very inadequate, because it only allows for protected disclosures internally, and what it doesn't allow for public disclosures. And what Patrick's now doing is going to public disclosures. And I challenged him. I said, when is this new overhaul of the legislation going to be done? And he said, oh, we should have a draft in a bill by the end of next month. I said, but you've been on this for over 2.5 years. What's keeping you so long? And then literally, and my blood pressure shot through the roof, and I had to go home. I was just getting, and I said, you know, I have whistleblowers phoning me late at night, telling me that there's some suspicious activity in their areas, and They don't have confidence in going to the police services.
Right.
They don't have – who do they go to? They speak to me in John Clark, a social worker who doesn't own a firearm and won't. And you know, I mean, just – and all I can do is – and I feel like so inadequate of just saying, well, I can counsel you. Is this real? Is it imagined and all the rest? And I mean, you don't have a therapeutic response at that level. Right. Somebody to intervene to immediately go there and put that person in a safe house, like we've done with other whistleblowers that I've helped. The one in Malawi recently, in a year ago, we managed to get him in a safe house because of his blowing the whistle and corruption in South Sudan. So, and you need to have this kind of determination. But the point is, we've got an election coming up in South Africa next year, as you have in the United States. And what I'm hoping we can do is make sure that every single political party and candidate states their commitment as a cross-party unifying principle that they are going to support the protection of whistleblowers and change the whole culture that currently prevails so that what happened to Patrick and people like that no longer happens. It'll be something which we will reminisce about of the dark old days of the past, as we do about what happened under apartheid. Yes. We certain places with young people today, when I tell them what went on under apartheid, they can't believe it.
Yes.
And the point is, it's so much easier, relatively speaking, to what we had to deal with under apartheid, because we've got a Bill of Rights, which is one of the is admired across the world. We've got the space and the obligation for people to speak truth to power without fear of without, in principle, a fear of retaliation from the state, freedom of conscience and all the rest, not a unilateral kind of, license, but a kind of an acknowledgement that a democracy is only as good as the participation of people in active citizenship in the decisions that are made, not just elections once every 5 years, but an ongoing engagement to ensure that there is real inclusivity and all the rest. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I believe that the next election is going to be a watershed. I do believe that the current government is a party is going to fail to get a majority, and we're going to be in a whole new situation where hopefully we can at least find consensus across the board on the fact that, you know, South Africa is going to go down the tubes if we don't arrest this decline into a failed state situation.
Yes. If you could, real quickly, John, could you explain the definition of state capture?
Yes. Well, it's basically when a concept that emerged from in Eastern Europe, you know, after the fall of the, you know, the whole collapse of the Soviet Union, where there were basically criminal syndicates that actually saw it not just to kind of influence legislation from the actual periphery in terms of discourse, but to actually get hold and to control the regulatory process so that they could actually call the shots, they could actually rig it to their particular interests. So that's and it's, you know, it's now become in South Africa the first, and I'm very proud of this fact, you know, the word state capture, the World Bank have used it, and it's there in the lexicon of definitions in terms of South Africa is quite unique in that we've had a commission of inquiry to investigate the state capture, and which is, you know, which of course is appalling what it's revealed, and we've had terrible and the progress in addressing all the necessary, you know, recommendations that have been made by our Chief Justice, who chaired the whole thing, has been appallingly slow. But he is our biggest champion of the cause of whistleblowers, and he's been saying repeatedly, he said, when the South African state is captured again, if we don't have proper protection of whistleblowers, we will have nobody to expose it.
That's right.
You know, that's, of course, you've heard Musila Motepo's interview you did with her, and that we they were the people that, and that's how, in fact, our group of solidarity group formed. It was out of those whistleblowers from state capture, and now it's broadened to include people like Patrick, who are blowing the whistle on corporate corruption, because that's the other side of it. You know, it takes two to tango. Everybody's been focusing on the state and its failures, and what we've now done with Patrick's story and others is to actually say, hang on, don't think South Africa's corporate community are actually blameless in this matter. Where did the actual bribery originally originate? You know, who paid for those special favors and those tenders and all the rest? And, you know, and of course, party politics, parties need money. And the ANC has had a very cozy relationship with Shell right from the word go. So that's why there's huge questions about Shell being in this whole thing. Sure. And, you know, their reputation in South Africa is not very good, particularly since they've also been in the news of late because of them. We haven't successfully stopped them from a seismic exploration off our wild coast, off our coast, where they were looking for oil and gas. And the same community that stopped the mining were the people that actually stopped Shell. So we're getting, I say this with great pride, because it just shows what a good constitution and the Bill of Rights can do, particularly since, and let me give credit now to one of your great, wonderful heroes, is Eleanor Roosevelt, where she made the point that human rights only acquire meaning in small places close to home. If they don't have meaning there, they have no meaning anywhere. And then Mary Robinson's wonderful statement where she says, and human rights don't belong to government. They belong to people. And we mustn't be, you know, naive in thinking that the Constitutional Court or lawyers or the government or anything else owns the Bill of Rights. They are citizen, they belong to people, and it's therefore up to us to actually make them real and meaningful. And we've done that, and we are doing it. So in that sense, Patrick, for me, I can think about these things theoretically, but to see people like Patrick coming out of the woodwork with stories, with absolute courage, and just knowing exactly what he can do. And for me to just be able to say, you know, Patrick, just read our constitution. There's your guidelines.
Yes. And you know, Patrick is joining the great list of whistleblowers, like, you know, Johannes Stephenson, who was the fish rot whistleblower who blew the whistle there in Africa on the Icelandic fishing industry. And Patrick, you're joining a roster of very impressive whistleblowers and people. And this stems, I think, when people ask, from your grandma, is that right? She instilled in you a love for truth. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, of course, yes. I was so post 1994, because my father was very, very active in the transformation of politics in South Africa. Amongst other things, he used to work with the guy called Eugene de Kock. I don't know if you know him. He was very, very brutal. At some point, I'm told by my dad that he came to our house and he held me down with my feet and he said to my dad, if he doesn't do what he wants him to do, he's going to, you know, kiss us goodbye. So my dad, you know, then decided that we must just come to Swaziland and live with my grandma, because they actually didn't know if he meant what he said and what was going to unravel towards 1994. So that's how we came to Swaziland, and then we had to live with my grandmother. And one of the good things is in Swaziland, there's traditions, there's a religion, which actually molded my values. He was a hard worker. My grandmother worked until she was 76 years old. And she spoke a truth to power. I mean, in the constituencies, because Swaziland is based on constituencies. That is how you raise your concerns, you raise your issues in the community. She was just known for being open, honest, and she always said that truth doesn't have feelings. She would say it as is. She didn't care how you feel about it, but she was at ease that she actually articulated herself in a manner that was correct and honest. So she taught me that, you know, better to live in the truth than to live in sin.
Yes.
So that's how I was brought up, to say that is your lane. And if you stay on this lane, you will never, ever go wrong.
She sounds like a wonderful woman. Yeah, wonderful woman. And you have followed through on her legacy, haven't you?
Absolutely. I did that.
But Patrick, you're currently at Heine.
Yes.
And you had to send your family away.
Yes, I had to send my family. Absolutely. I had to send them to Cape Town, because the scary part was when I was shot. And I realized this is just not a game. They actually had to leave. And fortunately, my wife was working from home, so it was easy for them to relocate.
So where is your case now, Patrick? Tell us where you're at in your case.
We actually had gone to the labor court. So the matter was taken to the CCMA, then from the CCMA, and then it was taken to the labor court for condonation, and the court granted us condonation so that the matter could be heard in the court. So I don't know if, John, you want to add some meat to that, please.
Well, just some of these terminology. We have very good labor legislation and paper. We have an institution which is called the CCMA, which is a Commission for Conciliation, Mediation, and Arbitration, as a way of trying to resolve, labor disputes and kind of occupational, issues, without it having to go in and burden the courts. But to have Patrick's disclosures declared as protected disclosures under our law, he needed to go firstly to the CCMA to see and try and exhaust mediation and arbitration. And fortunately, his lawyer was smart enough to say, look, and that we arrived there, and the commissioner was hoping he could try and get the parties to come to some sort of agreement. We said, no, we're just interested in your stamp of approval to go to the labor court. And that's the labor court is a proper judicial process where you have, as any court would do it, proper evidence-led representation. It's an adversarial process. And we had time to actually draft what they call a statement of case, which actually details exactly the story, and put that before the labor court. We had 90 days in which to do it in terms of the law, but we weren't able to get it done in time. And it was a genuine thing that we said, well, we'll just apply for condonation, which actually turned out quite useful, because it was now after 90 days. So the first hearing was just a kind of almost a procedural thing to say, listen, please, will you condone the fact that we are only making this after the 90-day period, which had the effect of putting it before the courts, which then meant that it was a public document and could now be spoken about. And that's why we seized the opportunity that immediately it was before the courts. I sat Patrick down, interviewed him, and you've seen the interview that I did, and we got the media to start reporting on it. Now, they thought we were just playing a clever trick by actually getting it into court, because, of course, no, journalists have to get the other side. And, of course, the other side wasn't ready. They were just arguing, no, you can't condone this. The judge had no hesitation in granting that condemnation. She could see very clearly that this was a valid case. And so these guys were left, on the other side having to try and, scramble. And of course, then I could make the public disclosure. Next thing, 2 months later, the chairman of Shell is forced to resign. He resigns. And I'm now engaging with Shell and others to say, come on, please. Come on, guys. The game's over. It's time for you to kind of come clean. We can play this lawfare game endlessly, or we can just say, look, let's sit down as adults and realize that, put it down to experience, find some sort of negotiated agreement that gives Patrick his job back, that gives him the compensation for the fact that he's had to suffer all this indignity, and also, that we can chalk this up as a very important statement so that other potential whistleblowers will come forward. Because that goes back to my point about the culture of whistleblowing. We're never going to break the back of corruption for as long as the current regime continues to intimidate and deter people from speaking truth to power, because, you know, we're not asking for people to be heroes. We're asking them to just to be honest, ethical citizens and to do their job. And people have got families and all the rest. I've been able to do what I do because I'm relatively, you know, my kids off my hands. I've got a wife who's had a decent job. She's been able to support me. You know, it should be the norm. It shouldn't be the exception.
Right. And well said. So, Patrick, what are your future plans? Tell us, where are you headed?
In this regard, there's a lot of confusion at the moment because I can't spend time with my family and I cannot be in a position to give you a clear answer right now because as things stand, the situation is intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you are a hero. I know. You know, it's sad our societies cannot recognize honest, truthful citizens. And that's what you are, Patrick. And I thank you for your disclosures. I thank you for speaking truth to power. And John, as always, I admire you and the work you're doing there. Anytime you want the National Whistleblower Center, the premier whistleblower attorney, Stephen Cohn, to come over to Africa to talk to your government officials, they're willing to do that. We are going to ask that if there's anybody out in our audience that has access to bulletproof vests, that is something that you two would appreciate. And I have to tell you how important your work is that both of you are doing in Africa. Thank you for being on the show today. John, would you like to say a few closing words?
I would want to just pay a debt of gratitude to the experience I've learned from your own history in the United States. I've always loved that quote from Theodore Parker, which keeps getting repeated and abbreviated, where he said, "The arc of the moral universe bends slowly, but it bends towards justice." Now, people know it in the version of Martin Luther King using it, and I know others have used it. I've been pondering, and this is a question you perhaps can put out there to your listeners, why does it bend slowly? And the thought occurred to me, because it's so slow at times, and what can we do to hasten that arc's bend? And it occurred to me that, well, what is justice presupposes openness and truth, and therefore the slowness is because of the attempts to retard the emergence of truth. Mm-hmm. So I just want to put that out as a thought to say, is that right? Why Theodore Parker made that point? And after all, he was a abolitionist. He was, you know, campaigning for the abolition of slavery in the United States, and he didn't even see it, I don't think, immediately in his lifetime, but it eventually came. I still do believe that we have, given the circumstances we are in the planet and the need for whistleblowing on the environmental front and all sorts of other things, we can't afford to delay things into the slow process. We've got to get truth circulating much more quickly, because only then will we get justice.
Well said, my friend. Well said. Patrick, we're going to let you take it out. Do we have your closing comments?
Absolutely. Thank you very much for actually giving me the platform. I really appreciate it. I hope it will reach the necessary people, and it probably will influence positively with regards to what we are trying to do. But lastly, I would like to ask you, Jane, to, from your experience, you have worked for the FBI. I actually had Shell send a former FBI agent who is based in Nigeria after I had made that disclosure globally to actually start investigating this issue. I want your word of advice to other whistleblowers or people who would want to be whistleblowers or previous whistleblowers with regards to what is it that you've learned in this journey with regards to dealing with whistleblowers? Because what I have learned is that by coming out and speaking truth to power, you are actually committing a career suicide, which is actually one of the barriers. You know, people, they would decide, I'm not going to talk, let me rather try and walk away because I don't want to jeopardize, you know, my house, family, and other things. And yeah.
Yeah, but I'll tell you very succinctly, Patrick, whistleblowing is a lifelong sentence. Yep, can't get away from it. Thank you, Patrick Maduna. Thank you, John Clark. You're both heroes in our eyes here in the United States, Europe, and in Africa. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
God bless. Happy Christmas to you.
Happy holidays. Thank you for listening. And please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Shake and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. Just as hard to stand up tall as it was when you were small. The truth is hard.